The thing is, I think so often success and failure, they look the same at a certain point. At a certain point in something that's going to be successful, it's like, what were we thinking? Why are we doing this? Nothing is working. It's all going wrong. And then something shifts and it starts to work. And I think that same thing is true in something that is just failing, right? It's like, why are we doing this? It's not working. And you have to know the difference between, you know, if what you're doing is something like Steve Jobs and Apple Computers, where it might take a while for even people inside of your own organization to come around to your way of thinking, or if what you're doing is something like the Segway, where you think what you're doing is really innovative and perhaps it needs to go back to the drawing board, or there are some kind of fundamental and basic problems with it.
This is the InnovaBuzz podcast, helping smart businesses be even more innovative.
Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Welcome to episode number 105 of the InnovaBuzz podcast, designed to help smart businesses committed to innovation, to service, and to modern marketing become even more innovative. Now, quick announcement before I introduce today's guest. If you want more information on marketing in today's world and some great articles and insights that our group put out together, then please join our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. It's no cost to join. Just go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. So innovabiz.co/TMAC. Hope to see you there soon. And when you first join, please introduce yourself to the group. In today's interview, we welcome back to the podcast Michael Mapes of Graveyard Innovation. Michael is a best-selling author, a strategist, and founder of Graveyard Innovation, which is a results-driven innovation firm that helps businesses, helps entrepreneurs, leaders, and organizations create and execute winning strategies. It helps them tell their story and develop their ideas so that they can grow. We spoke today with Michael about the changing landscape of the internet and how that's impacting on the ability of businesses to innovate. We spoke about running millions of experiments, not being afraid to fail, and how you can stand out by being a librarian for the internet. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Michael Mapes. Hi, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really honored to welcome back to the InnovaBuzz podcast, all the way from Kansas City in the USA, Michael Mapes of Graveyard Innovation. Michael was my guest on episode 51 of the podcast a little under a year ago, so it's great to catch up again, Michael. Of course, we also had your business partner, Jeanette Valentino, on episode 59. So welcome back to the podcast, Michael. It's a privilege to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm really happy to be back. It was one of my favorite interviews I did last year, and I've shared it all over, and I'll do the same with this one.
Oh, thank you. Now, last time we spoke, you shared a bit of your personal journey, so we won't recap on that. But what I'm interested in, I guess, is what's happened in the meantime. You still there?
I think I muted myself. Great start, Michael. Definitely. So people can go back if they want to hear kind of about my personal journey and what I've done. So what we do at Graveyard Innovation is we design and execute winning strategies for companies and entrepreneurs that have original ideas or original product lines or original services, because when you launch something that is truly innovative or truly original, truly unique, truly different, you don't really have a language to talk about it. You end up being the weird person at the cocktail party for a long time. And the thing is, I think so often success and failure, they look the same at a certain point. At a certain point in something that's going to be successful, it's like, what were we thinking? Why are we doing this? Nothing is working. It's all going wrong. And then something shifts and it starts to work. And I think that same thing is true in something that is just failing, right? It's like, why are we doing this? It's not working. And you have to know the difference between, if what you're doing is something like Steve Jobs and Apple Computers, where it might take a while for even people inside of your own organization to come around to your way of thinking, or if what you're doing is something like the Segway, where you think what you're doing is really innovative and perhaps it needs to go back to the drawing board, or there are some kind of fundamental and basic problems with it. So that's what we do. What I've really noticed right now is there's kind of two competing forces that I see in the world, and especially in the world of business. One of those forces is that there are there's more original, unique, individual, interesting, powerful ideas that are starting to that are all different stages, you know, from just starting to percolate in somebody's imagination to being in research and development to being ready to be brought to the market to, you know, ideas that are now inside of a scaling company that's growing really rapidly. And I think that's fantastic. I think at the same time, though, the other force that we see is we see this proliferation or this real mass spreading of easy answers, conventional wisdom, mediocrity, and conformity. And so I think, to me, there's a lot of things that it's like we have a lot of people talking about being curious, talking about being creative, talking about being innovative, talking about being original. But I think it's a real crossroads right now. I think as a culture, and as a world, like meaning as a business culture and entrepreneurial culture, and then also as a world, as to whether we really mean it with regards to doing interesting and innovative and creative things, or whether that's just kind of marketing buzzword or
yeah, that's right.
You know, paint that we put on the front. So I see kind of those two forces colliding, and I guess I'm kind of here to support and talk about all the people who are interested in advancing a truly creative conversation, a truly innovative conversation. Not that I have all the answers, but I just know that I think the world is better when there's more diverse and interesting people with more diverse and interesting ideas. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, there's so much I like about that. And one of the things you said, and I've always worried about this, I mean, I've been doing my business for 10 years and it's got InnovaBiz in the name, it's got innovation in the name, and I was concerned at the beginning because I heard a lot of talk around innovation in the corporate world, and it was, as you say, really just a buzzword. I mean, the execution looked a lot different, and in fact, those people that I thought were actually practicing innovation were often hampered by corporate structures or politics or whatever it might be.
One thing we have to remember about that, I think, too, is that we're not coming from a perfect past. You know, we're not coming from a world in which, you know, all people have been able to bring their opportunities to the table and have them evaluated fairly. And we're not coming from a world in which it's not like companies were perfect 50 years ago and now there are problems, right? It's
yeah,
like an
right.
evolution over time, and but that doesn't mean that the rate of evolution, I mean, that's incredibly important, right? Are things moving along quickly enough? You've got 70% of the workforce largely disengaged with what they're doing. So that, to me, is just one of the trends that you think might cause people to wake up. But often I think what happens is when we're faced with that choice, I mean, just like in our own lives, when we're faced with that choice to really confront reality and to start to move forward from that place, it's often very difficult to do, and it's very difficult to initiate change. And I think I see that in a lot of companies right now, where all the evidence, all the trend can be pointing one way, and people's ability to sort of suspend disbelief and argue otherwise, it's incredibly high because the reality would require, I mean, change and true innovation, I mean, the commercialization of new and interesting ideas requires certain things to fall away. It requires, and that requires a gigantic spiritual leap, right, for people to be honest, for executives to be honest about, is there a need for me in the way that there was? And that is asking a lot of people, but I think it's asking a lot of people not to do that as well, because the cost of not innovating is so very high. Like, one of the things that I see right now is customers have so much power because they can look up 50 businesses, 100 businesses, in some cases 1,000 or more businesses before they ever have to pick up the phone and have a conversation. And so I find that to be a very empowering reality, because to me it's like, all right, let's get customers more information. Let's help them make a decision. Let's be more transparent. Let's just deal with the reality that we're in. But I'm often sitting in like meetings where I just feel like people have not caught up to that particular reality, right? It's like, oh, we can kind of like keep our customers in the dark, or we can manipulate them, or like as if marketing is some voodoo magic thing, right, that can just distract people long enough to get them to pull out their credit cards. And I feel like those companies are not like I feel like that they're already irrelevant, you know, and so I feel like so much of it now, it's not really like if we'll innovate or if we'll evolve, like we will. It's just kind of like, is that really painful and long and hard and frustrating and a lot of people caught in the crossfire of it? Or is there some kind of more perhaps enlightened or illumined way to do it? And I think that's an open, really open question right now.
Hmm. And I like what you said there. You know, a lot of companies haven't quite caught up with the fact that the consumer does have power these days. I mean, we're working with a lot of clients right now on reviews, particularly Google reviews, and that if you look online, and most people do this when they buy something or when they're going to, even in the B2B space, they'll go online and they'll check out what other people have said about it. And the interesting statistic that I thought was people will trust reviews online from perfect strangers. You know, if a friend of mine says to me, that was a good place to go to, or this is a good business to deal with, I will trust that because I like the person, I trust the person. So I take that on board, and we've always known that. But with the online space, people will trust perfect strangers' recommendations, or if somebody says something bad about a business, people will trust that and take it at face value. So it's really important for the businesses then to engage their customers to, first of all, make sure that they're providing a really good experience, and then secondly, make sure that they're engaging with them after the experience so that, you know, the reviews are actually proactively gathered, they're good, and also that they're, you know, any experience that wasn't satisfactory, that can be dealt with.
I was just listening to Dan Pink with his new book, When, and I don't know, I'll probably butcher the subtitle, but I think it's something, it's about the science of timing, you know, and we know from studies of startups that the idea matters immensely, the execution matters immensely, but the sequencing and timing matters more than either of those elements. So it's not, you need to have a great idea. You need to be able to execute upon that idea. But sequencing and certainly, you know, dealing with strategy as I do, most people are not operating in what I would consider strategic thinking. They're operating in some version of short-term tactical thinking, which has a place. You know, which certainly has a time, but I was listening to Dan Pink, and he was talking about, you know, with regards to your point, just how important it is to, like, even if you've been struggling in an interaction, or even if you've delivered bad news, that people tend to remember the end of an interaction. Like, for instance, if your server gives you a free dessert at a restaurant, or says something really nice, or if they get it wrong, if they get your bill wrong, you know, that you tend that last interaction you have tends to impact and color the way that you view the entire experience. And one of the things that I've learned, you know, working with people in innovation and working with people strategically, there is a lot of failure involved. I mean, the whole point of one of the ways that you get to innovation, if you don't have, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars to fund research or to do focus groups or surveys or to test out a product, is you try it in small little groups, right? Like small little samples, and you fail and you mess up and you refine, and it's much better to do that on a small scale. So part of what I've learned is just the importance of staying in conversation with people, because, you know, there are some hard days in business generally. There's a lot of hard days when you're trying to do something that no one has done before, or maybe no one has done successfully before, or you're trying to do it in a bigger way, or you're trying to attract attention. So I think really staying in that conversation is so much of what people can do. And just because someone, you know, we're happy and irritated in moments, we're not happy and irritated as like state stuck in amber. And I think it is so important to stay in conversation, and also to be honest with ourselves. Like, so far as I know, no one has built like the flawless, perfect product that solves all problems. You know, I'm willing to be corrected on that, but I've yet to come across it. And I think what's so important about that is, if you're more honest, like none of us are 100% objective, but there are people you can hire that may have a higher level of objectivity. There are people in your life that, you know, may be less emotional. Like, I study Myers-Briggs just a little bit, so, and I'm an INTP. So, you know, one thing we're known for is accuracy. But there may be that person in your life that can see things clearly. Like, one of the things you should really, I think, try to do is be honest with yourself from the beginning about, okay, what is our value, or I try to go for like an invaluable proposition, right? The most valuable thing. And then where are we weak? Like, strategy is so much about knowing where you're going to compete and on what grounds. And if you're more honest with what value you're trying to bring to customers, then you can sort of see which criticisms might be really important for you to focus on and to try to correct, and which criticisms are not as important because they're not so centered around the value of what you provide. And I'll just say finally on that, you know, drinking Kool-Aid, and that is not attractive to anyone. That's not attractive. If you have people in your life who are, you know, Kool-Aid drinkers with regards to certain things, or certainly in a business, being able to see the weaknesses as well as the strengths of what you offer, that is a huge strength in life and in business. So I would say, you know, if you can get more real from the beginning about your identity as a company, then you can engage a whole lot of things around those reviews, and you can start to, I mean, even working with someone like you, Jürgen, it's like then they can like so much more effectively like frame and think about, okay, what do we want a website to do? How do we want it to do it? Why do we want it to do it? You know, really thinking about it as this fully living, breathing process and ecosystem, as opposed to, you know, just like a marketing brochure or something.
Yeah, that's really great advice, and I think I might actually steal the whole little paragraph. I think, you know, that's really great advice, and I like the idea of looking at an invaluable proposition, which is kind of part of, okay, what is unique about you, but then being really honest about, okay, well, what do we do and what don't we do, or what are we good at and what aren't we good at, and it may be perfectly okay to remain not good at the things we're not good at, but being honest about it, and then also being open to feedback, so that if there are areas where it would make sense to improve, to that you actually take that feedback in, and you can then do something about it.
So good as well, because when you genuinely care about what someone says, you know, like there are people, you know, there are jerks in business and jerks in our life where the feedback and the criticism someone is giving, it has very little to do with mm-hmm. us. You know, it's just their own nonsense or something.
Yep.
And you can
yep.
usually, just but that to me is such a small minority of people. Usually people have really diligent, really useful feedback. Now, that isn't to say that you take every piece of that feedback and reinvent your business every 5 seconds. But so often I think people are sending out these almost push-pull surveys, you know, that are like designed to essentially, you know, get the answer they want. And I just speaking from personal experience, it makes people feel so good when you set aside time to really hear them, to really listen to them. For me, it takes me a while. Like, I don't always know immediately how I feel when someone's giving me feedback or criticism. I need to process it and think about it. Because a lot of times I have that gut reaction of like, no, you don't understand. Like, this is what I'm, you know. But if you can just step back and really, you know, invite people in a respectful way and be respectful back, I think it makes people feel like they're a part of the process. And that to me is how you get from value to invaluable. That is how you really, you just start to create like marketing, advertising, copy and images, and just a whole aesthetic and kind of a useful experience in style and form for anybody that looks. It's like, oh, that's exactly what I was thinking. That's exactly, you know, what I was hoping somebody would say. Because we have to, when we're working in innovation, we have to create things that people don't know how to ask for. And I think that's really, you know, people, we can't just send out a survey and say, what would you like? Because, you know, it hasn't been made yet, right? And so we've got to kind of, we have to use curiosity and empathy so that we can take like the data, we can look at market research, we can use surveys, we can use focus groups, but then we can kind of eventually create the thing that solves the real problem people have. And I don't think it takes all that much, but I do think it's like you can, if you invite people into kind of a curiosity-driven conversation, it's just incredible how powerful it becomes.
Hmm. Yeah, that's really great advice. Now, you mentioned that your focus is on helping people with the long-term strategic stuff. I saw your website has on its home page the strategic storytelling process and the Idea Lab. So tell us a little bit more about your process. I'm really fascinated by that.
So I'm fascinated by the idea of narrative and storytelling because, you know, it's it predates Aristotle, you know, and a lot of our understanding. So a lot of how we filter things tends to be like in a very rational, Aristotelian, logical way. But, you know, storytelling is much older even than those ideas, right? If you think about tribal people or even the very, very oldest of humans, the way that people would explain the weather, the way that people would explain death, the way that people would explain the most important interactions that we have, right? Hunting, food, agriculture, all of that has to do with storytelling and the different stories that we tell ourselves and the different stories that we tell others and the stories that we choose to believe. But that in and of itself is not to say that every story is somehow strategic. And so what I'm fascinated by is how can you combine this way of making meaning with business and entrepreneurship so that the way in which you develop products and services in your business, the way in which you market your business, the way in which you make decisions about brand in your business, make decisions about team in your business, has cohesiveness and a coherence. You know, so often there are logical reasons why we do things, like I think this product will accomplish X, Y, and Z for me, but that is not the entirety of the story. Like if we just looked at that, we would be doing irrational things all the time, right? Like why do we buy a car that's $20,000, you know, more, even though it would do fundamentally the same as one that is $20,000 less? That has nothing to do really with the features. That has to do with something else. For instance, like if you have a story that a car is primarily a mode of transportation, then you may care immensely about the economic value of it or how much fuel mileage it gets or, you know, something like that. If you have primarily a story in your mind that a car is about luxury, then you may buy something different. If you have a story that a car is about status and representing something to the world, you have still something different. And of course, you know, that's a simplification because we have many stories coming from many different backgrounds of which one rises to the forefront. But you can see the way in which if you start to understand and engage with those stories that you can make a whole lot of decisions about your brand. If you look at something like Harley Davidson, okay, Harley Davidson is not like the best motorcycle ever to be manufactured in the world. But Harley Davidson is about meeting up with other people, sharing community, you know, going to Sturgis. And so what they understand very much is they understand the stories, the things that matter to their customers, and then they're able to create both a product and an experience that resonates and creates loyalty, creates cohesiveness, and creates economic value for the company. And that's the combination of strategy and storytelling. Storytelling is so much more than just like the message or something that you put on your website. It's the way that you interact with your customers. For example, I don't have a view that customers are lazy or stupid or distracted or, you know, I have a view that my customers know a lot more about their business than I do. I have a view that most people work extremely hard. I have a view that most people are honest people, right? So the way that we interact with people, it's never lecturing. It's never speaking over them or just assuming that the way we've done things is always going to work. It really incorporates hearing from these people. We don't come from the place as we're automatically the experts in this and you should listen to us. We come from the place of, okay, you're the expert in your idea. You have these values. What story can we find within that? And then how can we use our knowledge, what we know and what we're still learning, to really create a strategy that makes sense given all those factors? So like as I look at it, marketing, advertising, brand, those are not something you put into a business. Those are something that come out of a business very logically and easily when you put in the right ingredients, you know? And it's not to say everyone has to do it just like this. There's lots of ways to do that based on, you know, your own experience, background, what you're trying to accomplish, and lots of other variables. But that, to me, is how you kind of get a narrative emerges out of that. And then you have many different stories that you might tell in the course of your business. And I think it's not that complicated of a process. Like, I'll just give you one quick example. If you look at the election, the 2016 election, it's not that people in Southern Missouri or, you know, Arkansas or Mississippi or Texas had a fundamentally different idea about the election, like, say, compared to people in New York or California. When you look at exit polls, people did think Hillary Clinton would largely make a better president. They did think she had better policies on the economy, national security, education, you know, every area they asked about. Hillary Clinton's message largely penetrated. However, it was what people did with that information that was so different. You know, people in Brooklyn had one set of ideas about what it means that Donald Trump, you know, is unstable, you know, or might be a, you know, risky bet. But people in Southern Missouri saw that as a good thing. And that had everything to do with the stories that they were raised with, the stories they tell themselves, their worldview, the stories that they... So it's not... like to say that Hillary Clinton necessarily had a message that failed. It's just more, there was something in the framing that they didn't know how to get beyond, or, you know, they strategically weren't able to get beyond, or they didn't recognize it soon enough. And I think that's really important to understand, because storytelling, I mean, it's not that people just have a different set of facts. It's just like what we do with that and how we interpret the world, right? Mm. Whether those stories ring true, whether those stories make sense to us, that has everything to do with like the internal narratives and monologues that we're telling ourselves. And so I think it's really powerful for businesses to start to look at things through kind of that lens of both strategy and narrative.
Yeah. It's a good analogy, the politics. And I think, you know, translated into business, that requires that you have a really deep understanding of your customer at almost every level. You need to be able to empathize with them. And you know, one of the questions we ask when we go through an exercise where we try to understand our client's customer is, what are the stories that they're telling themselves? So, you know, and you alluded to that a little bit there. So
you can just ask them, like, often, right? You can actually, and I think, and it's so useful at the
But some of the, like, some of those stories are unconscious, right? They're beliefs that they've built up over years, their beliefs and values that they've established when they were, you know, 6 years old or before they were 7 years old. So they're...
And whether there's trust, right?
Yeah.
You know, we don't automatically, like, if someone sat me down and said, tell me the stories that are most important to you, you know, unless it was like my therapist.
Right? Yeah.
And even then, right, that's why people go to therapy for a while, because, or that's, you know, even what, if you look at psychoanalysis, what Freud and later Lacan and many contemporary people are trying to do, right? It's this idea that going back into the same memories, going back into the same stories, and that's what's so powerful between, like, your imagination and your customer's imagination and the conversation in between, like, somewhere in that matrix and somewhere in that mix is exactly what you're looking for.
Mm. Yeah, of course, you can ask... a lot of questions. You talk a lot about curiosity, right? So you can ask a lot of questions that are not psychoanalysis, but give you an idea of what people value and, you know, how they think and so on. So, and then the challenge is to be empathetic with that. And one of the things we ask in our work is, what does your client believe that you don't believe? Because that's, to me, that is kind of the essence of how can you be empathetic with that person. And, you know, that may actually highlight that, hey, we're at polar opposites and I can't actually work with that person, which is fine, because not everybody's a match. But it may be that,
absolutely,
you know, that person believes that money is the root of all evil, for example, whereas I believe that, you know, you need money to be successful and to make a difference in this world. So how do we match that up? How do I be empathetic to that person's belief? Because like you said before, it's not about talking down to them or lecturing them or telling them that what they think is wrong. It's about being empathetic and then crafting a message that they can use to their advantage.
And that's part of, I think, what people run into, because cliche often sounds like wisdom. And cliche often sounds like something interesting, but it isn't. Right. And so I think a lot of people, it's like you can't just like look at the front end of somebody's like marketing and then like use the same word. I mean, like you can, and a lot of people do, and it's a shortcut. And like sometimes it works in the short term. It doesn't work in the long term, and it often doesn't work in the short term. But I think, you know, with what you're saying, like that is so, like, I wrote that question down. Like, what is it that your client believes that you don't believe? Because, you know, beliefs are evolving and in motion, and we should be open to new evidence and them evolving and changing. And, you know, certain things are not like a matter of fact or a matter of doing a study or something like that. But I love that, and thinking about, okay, is this like a fundamental thing, as in like people who believe this would not be a client? Is this something we can move beyond? Is there something? I think it's just really powerful to imagine the world from a bunch of multiple perspectives. Because it does give you a deeper respect for it. And I just think this is something that has to emerge for people over time as well. Like, you should be, it gets richer, you know, as you go. And I always try to just be, like I said, I need a lot of time to think about how I feel about things, you know? So I'm always like trying to step back and I'm just amazed. Like, I'm just amazed. Like, every moment I think the world is shrinking or everybody thinks the same, like, you know, a real human being comes along to just disrupt that idea, to change that idea. And that's one of the things I think that's so important for people to marketing online right now, because, you know, I have a lot of concern about people who like conscious entrepreneurs, solopreneurs, freelancers, like, because to me, there's a lot of changes that are coming. You know, there's been a real corporate intrusion into the space. We're at a point right now where 96% of the people who are on the internet are going to be on the internet are on the internet, right? So until like North Korea and Myanmar opens up, there's not like vast new customer bases that are going to be getting online, because we've seen sort of the corporate consolidation of online learning and education. And the thing for me, the thing that really, really gives the smaller business, the solo entrepreneur, you know, the David rushing down the hill to fight like 10 Goliaths, the advantage is differentiation and uniqueness and originality. And I think especially in the beginning of a business, you know, there's a lot of talk about automation, and that's important at a point, and figuring out what to automate so you can, you know, free up your time, that matters. But I'm so interested in personalization before automation, you know, and really figuring out, okay, because when you're small, you can get so close to your customers. As you get bigger, you know, that's much harder. You know what I mean? And so I think being able to get really close to your customers, really curious, and then, you know, just be in process with them, that is the advantage. Like, that's something Walmart can't do that. Walmart can't have that kind of an intimate conversation with its customers. Like, there's too much distance there. There's too much bureaucracy. And so what I would say is, like, absolutely we can learn from people. Absolutely we can copy some processes from people. And absolutely we can automate. But when you're just starting out, like, differentiation and personalization, and if you can do those things, then, like, I believe you'll most likely at some point stumble upon or create a product or service that is really worth scaling. And I think so many people, it's like they rush, it's like they want to skip that step. But for me, that's the most joyous step of creating a business, is that deeply intimate, personal, powerful connection with somebody who's going to give you money. Like, I will never forget being 19 and somebody paying me $15 for 15 minutes of consulting. Like, that changed my life, because I was like, someone will, I mean, if they could give me one penny, it would have changed my life, right? Yeah, the idea that there was something I could think up that was actually valuable to another human, incredible. So I just encourage people not to rush past that and like embrace that, because so much power there.
That is such great advice. And you know, all this, I mean, I'm seeing a trend. I think this year is going to be a year of, where this idea of personalization is actually embraced by the people that are doing a lot of this automation and setting up systems, because I'm seeing a lot of people talking about how can you build personalization in, and I will put that in inverted commas here, into these automated systems. So, for example, if you have a email sequence that just follows along one line, so there's, let's say, seven emails that expand on a topic for which people signed up for, building into that some artificial intelligence or via questionnaires or whatever you might do, where there's decision steps along the way. So let's say Michael's more interested in A, whereas Jürgen's more interested in B. So we get sent different content that's more personalized to what our interest is. I'm seeing a lot of that happening. So I think people are recognizing that personalization is actually getting lost by some of the automation here and trying to backpedal or build it in. But I think what you said in terms of actually having that one-to-one personalization, that is actually so valuable, and that really can differentiate you. And, you know, Seth Godin says, find the smallest audience that you can live with and absolutely delight them, obsess over them, really get to know them, and, you know, you're going to grow.
Exactly, because then you can make such smart, strategic choices. Like, I think we have to, like, remember that like-based and interest-based advertising is not the end-all and be-all of the conversation. Because, again, we only know to ask for what we know to ask for. And we only know, like, typically, if you ask me what, like, I don't know how to say my favorite food is a food I've never tried. Right? I only know how to say my favorite food is mashed potatoes. My favorite food is ice cream. You know, like, I only know something that I've tried. So it's like, if you're going to, like, say, and Michael likes B, you can absolutely personalize on that. And you can also remember that maybe that's because Jorgen's never been exposed to A, or it hasn't been framed in the right way. And I think we need to get the data, but then we need to really intuitively and intelligently, based on knowing our own customers and our own company, our own goals, as well as our customer's goal, interpret that data. And I think so often it's like the rate of everything right now is such that people are really Like you can have validity without data. I heard Roger Martin say, and I like that way of thinking about it. Like, you can read certain things into this and then test it out. It's just a hypothesis. It might be completely wrong, or it might be completely right, you know, or it might be somewhat right, or it might. So I encourage people to be like, it's not all or nothing, success or failure. Like, you should be running a million little experiments and tests in your business all the time. Like, if I want to know if a narrative I've created for a client is strong enough, I just start calling up podcasts, radio shows, and pitching it, right? I start calling up TV producers, and you know what? They tell me no if it's not strong enough. And then I can go back to the drawing board rather than, okay, let me just fret about this for like days and days and days or weeks and weeks and weeks, right? I can actually just call up people and say, hey, is this strong enough or not? And there's all these kind of tests that you can design. So I think it's like, to me, it's that real power between rationality, reason, and data, and intuition and emotion. It's like the conjoining of both of those. And I think I just think that offers a whole lot of potential. And I'm really glad to hear what you're sharing there, that people are involved in that conversation. And you have to look at too, I mean, I think it was, it's like, was the system really, what is the system set up for? Because so often the systems we set up are doing exactly the thing we set them up for. And often I think compassion, curiosity, care, and, you know, genuine interest and empathy was not built in early enough. So you may have to go back and revise some of the systems. And I really would just say to anyone out there, sometimes there is a short-term loss when you do that, or sometimes it's like everyone else looks at you like, what are you doing? That's so crazy. That's so odd. But I really believe there's a long-term gain, because a lot of these things, like, there's so much information online, and you can go to people and learn about how to do Facebook ads, how to write copy, how to, you know, like a bunch of marketing stuff. And that's all great. It's just, I would just encourage you to remember that often what's happening is people are providing a framework based on what generally works, but you are not running like a general business. You are running your business. And so knowing when the rules generally apply and you should follow them, knowing when to follow conventional wisdom and when to divert from that and where and at what time, that to me is really what makes the difference. And, you know, that's what to me makes it wonderful, that because there's no one strategy for success. And I have to say, I think the world would be quite boring if there were.
Yeah, well, that's really good advice. And I like the idea of lots of little experiments. I mean, that encapsulates innovation, doesn't it? You sort of get out there with an idea and test it out very early, rather than hide away to build it out into a complex product or system before you've actually tested it out. So I was going to ask,
very hard for people to connect with that. You know, I think you've done all, it's like people, and people, then you have your whole, this whole language around it that people may, or, and it's just very expensive to do that. Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah. I was going to ask if, you know, if you had some practical actions people could take to deal with, you know, all these challenges that are around, and you've talked a lot about disruption, and there's plenty of examples of that happening today, and, you know, examples that I've lived through in the past that have had some pretty major consequences. So how can small businesses that, you know, can act in a nimble way and quick and adapt quickly, what practical actions can they take to deal with that?
I think, you know, one place people can look is certainly to, like, look into design thinking, which if you just Google it, you'll find a lot of lot of resources. I think it that offers, like, a general framework for what we're talking about. And, you know, there's many versions, and we've adapted, you know, certain things from, like, agile project management and design thinking. So I think really it's not, obviously, when you're dealing with creativity, it's not to say you can completely structure and systematize it, but there are ways that you can generally create space and create strategies, like for yourself within your business, or if you're part of a larger organization, that will start to ensure that you have, first off, enough ideas in your pipeline. Because I think, you know, really ensuring that there's enough that you're working with is so important, so that you can actually choose the best ideas. I think, and then making sure that there's space for you to fail. I think that's huge. The second thing I would say to small business owners, entrepreneurs, I think right now, really what I'm seeing is it's really important, I think, to look at the fact that information is, and this is not actually a phenomenon of the internet, although perhaps it's been exacerbated by it somewhat, but information is not really at a premium value, because it is so widely available, because it is available, and some of that's like what I'm talking about with, like, corporate e-learning, like the price has been very driven down by sites like Udemy, and you know, just the mass availability of all kinds of information. And so what becomes valuable, so the good thing about that is that the barrier to entry in a lot of these areas is extremely low, and that we can, there's still some problems with access, but we're approaching something, you know, much closer to universal access, and that's good. So what becomes valuable in an economy where information is widely available is curation and context. I think it's weird we don't have librarians for the internet, because we used to go into a library that was a very small amount of information compared to, like, you know, if you think about the internet, or if you even think about, like, EBSCOhost or Google Scholar or anything like that. I mean, that's like nothing. A library is nothing compared to that. And yet we had people who went to college to get advanced degrees to be able to locate information in a relatively small architecture of information. We don't really quite have that for the internet yet. And so I think it's all about creating curated and contextual experiences that help clients, customers, people seeking different products and services cut through all of that information and access either what they need, or create useful, interesting, unique experiences based on that as well. So I know that's kind of like more of a framework thing than a practical action, but if you can start to think about what is it that I already know, or what information do I already have, or what have I already, you know, like what am I looking at, and then how could I create some additional value in my market, industry, niche, for my client base, for my customer base, that no one else is doing? And the other, like, thing I would say is trust has been extremely violated. And we don't have to debate the merits of whether or not it should be. It's just a matter of fact that when you look at people's approval ratings of politicians, when you look at how people think about business, when you look at what people think about advertising, public trust and civic trust are at all-time lows. When you look at what people think of journalism, I mean, it's nearly across the board. And so part of what we have to do, because I don't really see the change coming politically at this moment, I hope it does, but I don't see that. But I think part of what we need to do as entrepreneurs and business owners is, okay, realize the compact has been violated because marketing and advertising has not always been truthful. And so how can we restore that trust? And so one of the things I think people can do is really look at every process in their business, but particularly their sales process or their enrollment process, really their, you know, how are you selling your product, and say, how can I put the power back into my customers' hands? How can I let them make a choice? And how can I trust that they will? And I think, you know, you have to get creative around that. But I really think if you can do some things that start to create a trust framework or a trust infrastructure between you and your customers, or if you can ask them about their past experiences, maybe to start to get at what needs to be different, I think that's one of the most practical things people can do, because, you know, I'm just seeing a lot of people just very, it's like they're turning away from everything because trust has been so violated. And so I think part of what we have to do is recognize that, acknowledge that, you know, fairly or unfairly, and start to work within that and say, okay, where can I bring more transparency? Where can I bring more trust? Where can I bring more confidentiality, perhaps, in some cases, to depending on who your clients are? But what are the things, and think, you know, how can you get creative around building trust between you and your customers? For us, that means sometimes we do have a little bit of a longer sales process than some people do, but it also means we don't really have people who stop being our customers, you know? So it's, you have to figure out what that is for your business and your products. But I think context curation, and then looking at where you can instill trust in your business, those to me really are kind of the keys to success moving forward. Like, because I look at us like we're going into an age of innovation and into an age where I believe we need to involve customers so we can evolve our businesses at the speed of innovation. So I think those are some of the keys to it.
Yeah, I really like that. You know, when you started about there's so much information out there and the learning, it's easy to access learning and so on. My thought was, but there's so much rubbish there. You know, 90% or 80, let's call it 80-20, 80% of it is rubbish. But, you know, what you've said, and I that's the best analogy I've heard for this curation and context part, is a library for the internet and tailored to your own particular audience. In other words, pulling out the stuff that is actually really valuable and genuine and delivering that to them and putting that together in a way that is of enormous value to them. And that helps with the trust part. And I think the trust part is really important, because as you point out, you know, it's I mean, you know, I watch the news every night and a politician gets up and says something. And I remember the other night my wife said, oh, so-and-so said he's going to do this. And I said, well, he can say what he likes, but you know, what's going to happen? It may or may not be the same thing. So that's how we feel about politicians. You're right. That's how we feel about kind of media in general. And so, you know, to me, I mean, I tell people marketing really isn't rocket science or anything. It's about delivering your message, which, you know, has got to be honest and genuine and heartfelt, and but in a way that, you know, it gets to the people that you can actually help and make a difference, which is what you talked about very early on, you know, getting, and, you know, I like to work with people who have that buzz when they've made a difference to somebody else, you know, regardless of what they were paid for it, but get that buzz. So, you know, getting that message to the right people at the right time and in the right way that builds the trust and delivers them exceptional value. So
I think so often we've had this framework that says, I can't really be honest with people. You know, I can't really tell people the truth because it's not what they want to hear. And I believe so often in life, I mean, I'm like this. It's like we rise to the bar that is set for us. And if people set a low bar for us, that's like, oh, they're all sheep, I just have to tell them what they want to hear, well, we will largely rise to that bar. Yeah. You know, if we start to raise the bar higher and say, you know what, it might be hard sometimes for people to hear the truth or a version of the truth or the truth as I see it, but generally people want to hear the truth. Generally people want honesty and integrity, genuineness and sincerity. I believe people will more and more start to rise to that bar.
Hmm. Yeah, and I think, you know, for me, the people that have this idea of, oh, we can't be honest with our audience or with our clients, you know, we can't tell them what our costs are or so on. I mean, sure, you don't divulge trade secrets or anything, but
there's absolutely things that are appropriate.
Confidential.
Yeah.
But, you know, be dishonest in a way that not just withholding, but giving false thing. I mean, to me, that's a reflection of the person doing it.
It's such a short-term strategy. Mm. And I just feel like, let me know how that works out for you in the long term, because people really do over time truth just has a funny way of coming out, you know, and quality really does rise to the top. And I would just say, I think there is a lot of nonsense out there spiraling around, and some of that has to do with, you know, the internet is older now, but it is not old, and we are still figuring out. I mean, it's not like we had a perfect system before for sorting out what was true and what wasn't, because a lot of people couldn't publish their ideas before, couldn't, right? There were such traditional gatekeepers that created a problem. Now we have kind of the other side of it, where perhaps we need some gatekeepers, but I think it's important to remember, like, all of that uncertainty and all of that sorting out process, that is entrepreneurial opportunity. That uncertainty opens so many doors that have never been opened for people. And so it's like, let's step into the gloriousness of that uncertainty and see, like, what ideas are waiting to be harvested.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely agree with that. All right. Well, I'm conscious of the time, Michael, and don't want to take up too much of your time. And also the audience might be getting a little impatient with us. So I might move on to the innovation round. I know you've done this before and you've probably answered several of these questions anyway, but maybe you could just give us a very short summary for the ones that we've covered in detail, like the first one, which is the number one thing anyone needs to do to be more innovative.
I would say fail more.
Fail more. Okay. Yeah. So more experiments and be prepared to fail more. Yeah.
More being honest about what's working, what's not, looking at the lessons and really trying to figure out what went wrong. You know, sometimes it's like, if you run the same experiment on five different days, you'll get five different results for reasons you have no idea why. And sometimes there's a very clear reason, you know, why something went wrong. And, you know, I'm reading a book right now that I would completely recommend, called The 33 Strategies of War. And I'm reading a chapter right now about Napoleon. And what it talks about in that chapter is, our biggest obstacle to future success is our past success. Because we're so tempted to rely on what worked last time or what we did before. And that is not always what's going to work into the future. So I would say, yeah, fail. Yeah. Be willing to fail more often.
Yeah, that's a great advice. So who wrote that book, The Strategy of Lore, as in L-O-R-E?
That is written by Robert Greene, I think.
Okay, we'll post links to that as well.
If I'm wrong, I apologize to the author of that.
All right, well, we'll track it down. Yeah. we'll find it on the internet. What's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas or products?
Listen to people. Yeah. listen between kind of the lines and to what people are really saying. I mean, it's kind of like Sherlock Holmes, you know, there's a power in observation and there's a power of hearing. And, you know, sometimes it's interesting because if you do some of these interviews or you listen to people, like, I'll go around with my team and I'll say, okay, what did you just hear? Because we do not hear things the same way, right? It's like, really, you heard that? Because that's not what I heard at all, right? And that's, of course, where sense making and storytelling and meaning making all come into play. So, I would say the more I close my mouth and the more that I listen, it seems the more interesting ideas I have to execute on.
Yeah, okay, great advice. Yep, and I love it because a lot of people don't understand that idea of when you and I are in the same room listening to the same person deliver a message, that both of us will go away with a totally different view of what he said.
And there's a power in hearing, you know, someone else's perspective in that, I think. It's like, whoa, okay.
Yeah. All right. Do you have a favorite tool that you use to do your work with storytelling and in Graveyard Innovation?
I do. Legal pads and Sharpies. For sure. I mean, yeah. By a lot, you know. And, I've really gone back to, there's a difference between profound, powerful simplicity and, you know, simple. And I think, I'm a huge fan of simple. I'm a huge fan of free. Like, you know, big corporations are being strategic with every penny. And so we have to think about that as well as entrepreneurs, where we're putting our resources. And like, I put a lot of money into educating myself, into getting coaching and mentoring and learning the skills that I feel that I need to learn. I don't put as much money into technology. Some where needed, but like, you know, really like Google Drive, Slack, HubSpot, CRM, those are all free. And that pretty much runs, you know, our business.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the legal pad and Sharpies. Yeah, so I'm a big fan. So I've got three whiteboard type things plastered up on my wall here, and I love to get up there and draw on them. And I've recently purchased a whiteboard book. So it's actually an A4 book, but it's all whiteboard paper and some pens.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And I'm really excited too, between this like this fusion of like, I'm kind of surprised we haven't come to it sooner, but this fusion between handwriting and technology, like I'm really excited for some of the interactive whiteboards and like, you know, the notebooks right in that. So I think there's we're starting to get to this place of like taking the best of humanity with the best of technology, and we're still finding our way, but I think it offers a lot of possibility.
Yeah. So I love the whiteboard, and then I take a photograph of it with my smartphone, and then I can put it on the computer somewhere and find it easily later on rub off the board and draw of something else.
Yeah, cool. Hmm.
All right. What's the best way to keep a project on track?
Oh, my. I'm probably the worst. You should probably ask anybody else on my team, but not have me work on it perhaps would be the answer to that. I think I would say discernment, really knowing when to stay the course and knowing when you need to change course. That's why education and learning, I'm just a huge, you know, I know there's a lot of like bashing of traditional universities and all of this, but I am just a huge fan of like learning generally. But why it's important to learn a lot is so that you have enough frameworks in your mind. So that at the moment, right, the moment of choice, do I go with an established framework or do I try something new, that you can decide? And I would say that, right? Sometimes you kind of let something go. Sometimes it's time to see it through. So I think discernment, and that includes discernment with how much planning to do. There is time to think about something a lot, and then there is time to just kind of go and muddle your way through. So I would say that's kind of the good when experiment. I trust myself on that, I tend to do better. Mm.
Okay, that's great advice. Yeah, and I love the focus on education. I think that's really important. And maybe that answers the next question: what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
So, I think hold it as a value, number one. And I would say, I heard Wayne Dyer, or I read Wayne Dyer somewhere, say talking about, you know, at the beginning of an idea or a project, it's like hands off my imagination. And that I think that's true. I think in the beginning, when you have a new idea, it's like this little tiny about to grow thing. You don't go ask everybody what they think about it, not because people are ill-intentioned, but because they don't, like, it's in your head, in your heart, and you know why you're excited about it, but you may not be able to explain it yet. So I think in the beginning, it's like really giving yourself space to explore that idea, then getting feedback, you know, once it's had some time to grow. But I think it's really holding at your core that doing something original, doing something unique, and doing something different is a value that you want to have. You know, not everybody has that value. Some people do have the value of mediocrity, conformity. And so I think it takes a real kind of conscious effort to say, you know, the one thing or the two things that this world is you know, it's not fair. Fairness has nothing to do with it, and it operates in a million infinite originalities. You know, So I think it's really holding that's the whole thing that makes, you know, life so wonderful. And for me, it's the thing that makes business exciting and fun and worth doing.
Mm. Yeah, that's great advice. All right, so embed that in your values. Now, what's the future now for Graveyard Innovation and for you?
Well, we're always looking for interesting, unique, original ideas or people who want to do some aspect of, you know, what they're doing differently. And, you know, I believe, you know, doing it differently so that you can win, so you can be profitable and make money and, you know, accomplish your values or scale your company or whatever the case may be. So I hope what's next for us is that we just continue to work with really interesting people that, you know, we want to be a part of their projects and that they want to be a part of our projects. One of the things that we have going right now is we did create kind of an offshoot or inside of Graveyard, a speaking agency called the Bisong Mape Speaking Agency. And if you go to speakingagency.biz or graveyardinnovation.com, I'll link it up on there. You can find your way to that if you're interested in speaking. We are an actual agency, so we book you gigs, and then we get a percentage of that. So that's kind of my next immediate thing to work on, is to really groom and develop our speakers over there. But, you know, the main thing I hope is just that we continue to have the opportunity to work on projects that are fun, unique, interesting, and contributing to the world in a positive way.
Great. I look forward to seeing how those things go. And I'll certainly post links to all the things that you've mentioned in the show notes. Now, what's the number one piece of advice then you'd give to any business owner that wants to be a leader in innovation?
Wow. You know, I always question if anyone's looking to me for advice. I'm like, oh no. Just temper that. I think, you know, some of the things that I've you know, said obviously speak to that a little bit, but what I would say is I don't have, you know, the one thing someone can do or the easy answer. I tend to offer more questions than answers, which frustrates my clients and friends and family sometimes. But I think what I would say is, you know, I believe that we can learn from others, that we can listen from others, that we can learn a lot of great skills from other people and other people's experience. And I also believe that trusting your own experience is so important. When I think about someone like Frederick Douglass, for example, who you know, was a slave and was taught to read by the slave owner's wife or, you know, mistress or something like that, and the thought entering his mind that I want to learn how to read, and from that I want to be free. Nothing in his world told him that possible, that he should desire that or want that at all, and yet something inside of him said, this is what I want to do with my life. Or Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony, no one was saying that women should have any rights, let alone the right to vote, and something in her experience said, no, I should have this right, I do have this right, and I'm going to spend the next 70 years, you know, fighting for this right. And so I think it is that balance between the expertise and experience of others and finding a way to really courageously listen to that inner voice, because our experience, you know, also matters, and it does speak to us. And so it's like, what is your life, you know, trying to show you or tell you about what's possible and you know, what your life is for? I think that's kind of what I would say, really listening to that powerful, small, still, sometimes nagging voice of your own experience. I think that's so important.
Yeah, that's great advice. So some really good examples there where, you know, people have kind of gone inside to develop an idea that, you know, there was no logical reason why they should come up with that idea, given the circumstances that they were in. All right, this has been absolutely fabulous, Michael. Really enjoyed this again, as per usual already. Where can people reach out and get in touch with you, say thank you, and continue the conversation if they want to?
Yeah, you can email me, m@graveyardinnovation.com, or you can go to our website, which is graveyardinnovation.com, or you can text me or call me, and our number is 309-430-9836.
Okay, fantastic. So we'll link to all of those in the show notes as well. So finally then, who would you like me to interview on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, and why?
Oh my gosh, that's so hard. I like all the people that you do interview. So I think I would like you to interview Gigi Bisong, who is, we partnered together in our speaking agency, but she's a former client, and she's amazing. She has a company called Live by Miracles, which does work with parents and stakeholders and principals and teachers and kids in urban schools, and really combines circling, which is a non-judgmental listening practice, with storytelling to bring everybody to the table and to get these communities really brainstorming, you know, solutions that would make their local school, local community better.
Sounds fascinating. So it was Gigi, was it?
Yes, Bisong, B-I-S-O-N-G.
Okay, well, Gigi, look out for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Michael Mapes. All right, well, thanks again, Michael. I've really enjoyed sharing all this discussion and information with you, and for you sharing your insights with us and the audience on the InnovaBuzz podcast. It's been fabulous. I've learned a whole heap more than I did the last time I spoke with you. I wish you all the best for the future of Graveyard Innovation, and let's keep in touch again.
Thank you so much, and thank you for doing the show. I think it really shines through, and like I said, you have great guests.
Thanks.
I always enjoy talking with Michael, and this episode was no different. His energy, his passion and enthusiasm are infectious, and of course, he shared a lot of great information with us. All the tips and ideas that Michael shared with us can be found at innovabiz.co/Michael Mapes. That's innovabiz.co/MICHAELMAPES. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Michael Mapes. You'll also find contact information for getting in touch with Michael there, as well as links to his website and the other things that we spoke about on the episode. Michael suggested I interview Gigi Bisong of Lit by Miracles on a future InnovaBuzz podcast. So, Gigi, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Michael Mapes of Graveyard Innovation. If you haven't already done so, head on over to iTunes or Stitcher or Pocket Casts and subscribe to the InnovaBuzz podcast so you'll never miss a future episode. We'd also love you to leave us a review, and we always welcome feedback. Now, reviews both let us know how we're doing and also help us get found by more people. If there's anything you want us to cover on a future InnovaBuzz podcast, or questions you want answered, or if you've got suggestions for guests we should interview, then please send those ideas to us. Finally, another reminder about our fantastic LinkedIn community at the Transformational Marketing Academy. No cost to join, just go to innovabiz.co/TMAC. That's innovabiz.co/TMAC. I hope to see you there soon. And when you first join, please do introduce yourself to the group so that we know who you are and what you're about. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember to be awesome and keep innovating.